This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about ageing, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Welcome to Series 3 of the MDT podcast. I am Dr. Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician at East Surrey Hospital.
And I am Dr. Jo Preston, and I'm a consultant geriatrician in London.
And we're now on the third series of the MDT podcast. And we're going to kick off with an episode on multimorbidity. But during this series, we're going to do things just a little bit differently. We're going to have guests in some of our episodes.
So today we have with us Mairead O'Malley, who is a pharmacist.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me.
And Mairead is going to help us with the first two episodes of this series.
Mairead's been on our faculty for a little while, helping us develop episodes. So we're really excited to have her here today and hear all her comments, of which she will give us plenty, I'm sure.
And this first episode is dedicated to someone that Jo and I know very well, Dr. Jim George, who is a consultant geriatrician in Carlisle.
Who sadly died over Christmas. And he was a really great geriatrician.
He was great.
A really inspiring mind. It's a very sad loss.
Yeah. So this episode is dedicated to Jim. So we're going to kick off with some stuff that we've seen this week that has perked our interest.
So I wanted to talk or tell you all about a book that I heard someone talk about at a improvement conference. It wasn't anything to do with improvement. It's a book about a man who gets dementia, written by his son, who is actually a cartoonist for newspapers and magazines. And the book is called Take Care, Son. And it's really, really nice. It's quite a short book, kind of cartoon style drawings, kind of through the journey. It's kind of a conversation with his dad from the beginning to the end.
Nice.
It's really, really beautiful, really, really nice.
Oh, nice.
So I would recommend that people go and have a read of that and let us know what you think about it. You can get it on Amazon or anywhere else.
So what I have this week is I have an article that I spotted in The Lancet looking at socioeconomic status in the 25 by 25, and I'll explain that, risk factors as determinants of premature mortality. Now, the 25 by 25 is a move to try and reduce mortality from non-communicable diseases, so non-infectious diseases, essentially, by 25% by 2025 across the world.
Okay.
And so this article was looking at, are those risk factors, things like obesity and smoking and stuff like that, enough to do that, or is there other stuff that we could do? And they then looked at socioeconomic circumstances in about 1.7 million people. And what they found, I guess kind of unsurprisingly really, is that we really should be targeting socioeconomic circumstances both locally and globally with our health strategies. And it made me think about our MDT and really highlighted to me the importance of referring people to the social services just to get them started in that direction of trying to maximise what we can for their, particularly their economic situation.
Their living situation and everything like that. So, I mean, the biggest, that kind of fits, doesn't it? Because the biggest advances in healthcare in the last couple of centuries have been sanitation and living conditions, have not been anything actually medical. We'd like to say it is. Obviously, that accelerates things. But actually, those were the biggest advances. So that's good to hear, isn't it? I think also linking into development links into kind of global aging, so new aging populations, where actually non-communicable diseases are the things that people are now dying from. If you live above 50, those are the things. So targeting all of those risk factors and poverty and things like that are probably the biggest things that we can be doing for those areas right now.
I think it's interesting though, because I think we gravely underestimate the conditions that people actually live in. And, you know, my job at the moment has been going out visiting people in their own homes, and having come from 8 years in secondary care completely opened my eyes to actually those really isolated, vulnerable older patients and the conditions that some of them are living in. So I think, you know, it's very easy to kind of just isolate a condition in hospital or at a GP practice. Nobody really ties that together.
Yeah.
So if you spotted anything that you want us to know about this week, please tweet it to us, and we're at MDT_podcast. And let us know where you're listening, tips that you come across, anything really that you think other people would like to know, send it to us and we'll pop it in the website and on the show notes for these episodes. So should we crack on with this episode?
Let's.
So this episode is on multimorbidity, and we're going to talk through some of the differences between frailty, multimorbidity and disability. I'm really going to use the 2016 NICE guidelines to frame a lot of what we're going to discuss today. And you may want to print the guidelines out and maybe follow them through as we're talking through, because we're going to kind of stick to those.
Yeah, they kind of cover everything that we would have talked about anyway. So we decided we'd just talk through the guideline and kind of give you a bit more information as we go along.
And I think one of the key things we want to pull out is to appreciate that a person-centred approach is required when managing patients with multimorbidity.
So we're going to start with a hypothetical case, which is taken from an Age and Ageing article published in 2013, to have a think about, as we go through the guideline, as to how this might apply to this person. So she's Mrs. A, she's 78, and she has had a heart attack in the past. She's got type 2 diabetes, osteoarthritis, COPD, and depression.
And I think the point of the multimorbidity guideline is because if we stick to traditional guidelines for this patient...
For each individual condition.
So she's got five mild to moderate diseases. She would be on at least 11 medications, with potentially another 10 more.
Mm-hmm.
She would be advised to routinely engage in 9 lifestyle alterations and self-care programs. She'd be expected to attend somewhere between 8 and 10 GP or primary care appointments for her physical conditions, another 4 or 6 for her mental health condition, and somewhere between 8 and 30 psychosocial intervention appointments for things like depression, smoking cessation, pulmonary rehabilitation, and all those things.
Which is crazy, isn't it? Because, well, it's not crazy. It's evidence-based. But that's a fairly typical person. I wouldn't say that person's even particularly complex for people that we encounter regularly.
No, absolutely not. And actually, it's interesting you say evidence-based because, you know, if we think about it, you know, 60, 65 onwards, the evidence that we're treating people according to, they don't apply to this age group. There is, I think, only 2 trials that were done in older people. So actually we're treating them with evidence.
So it's extrapolated. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Hence really where the multimorbidity guidelines from NICE sits.
Yeah, and why it's important.
And why it's important.
So we will start with the definition. The definition of multimorbidity is the presence of 2 or more long-term health conditions. They can include physical or mental health conditions, so diabetes, schizophrenia, and more ongoing conditions like learning disabilities. They can be symptom complexes like chronic pain or frailty, and they also include things like sensory impairments such as sight or hearing loss and things like alcohol or substance misuse.
And I think it's worth saying up front that there is a difference between multimorbidity and frailty. Mm. They are very interlinked, and a lot of patients who are frail have multimorbidity. A lot of patients with multimorbidity may also be frail, but they can also be mutually exclusive.
They're distinct entities.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about that in the frailty episode. So if you didn't catch that one, go back and have a listen if you want to know a little bit more about that.
So basically, the NICE guidelines are split into 3 sections. The first bit is about how to recognise multimorbidity. The second bit is about what to do with it. And they use polypharmacy as the main example, and we'll stick to that today. And then the third section is about recommendations for implementation of the guidelines.
And we're not going
really
to cover that bit.
No.
It's fairly straightforward, so you can read it for yourselves. There isn't really anything controversial there. So
the guideline, if we go through the guideline now, I think it starts off with some general principles.
In terms of the general principles, they talk initially about being aware that management of risk factors for future diseases can be a major treatment burden for people with multiple morbidities and should be carefully considered when optimising patient care. So this would include things like postural hypertension and tight blood glucose control. We will also think carefully about the risks and benefits for people with multimorbidity of individual treatments recommended in guidance for single health conditions and discussing this with the patient alongside their preferences for care and treatment. So really the key point is keeping the patient at the very centre of every discussion that you're having. And the approach that you take to that is really important.
Because those risk factors, although they're when people have single disease and they're not complicated by anything, then actually those are really important things. But as you mentioned, like tight blood pressure control, actually when people are starting to fall or having symptoms of postural hypotension, actually you may not be able to follow your guidance. You have to loosen that a little bit.
Yeah.
And with the blood sugar control, you were saying, actually in people with dementia and multimorbidity, you kind of loosen the target HbA1c because having low blood sugars is actually more dangerous for people generally.
And then the guideline goes on to talk about a general approach to care, and really it talks about seeing the whole person and how the approach to care should take account of multimorbidity and thinking about, I guess, when to start thinking about a multi-morbidity or holistic treatment plan for the patient versus sticking to your individual organ or disease-specific guidelines.
So they kind of mentioned kind of opportunities that you might have to recognise that someone has multi-morbidity and actually potentially needs a different approach. So they said things like difficulty managing or starting to have difficulty managing day-to-day activities. So they may present to a physio, a community physio, because not walking around as much. They might present to social work.
Or
needing a new
therapist.
Care package. So there's lots of different ways that these people may present.
Or when somebody receives care from multiple services. Mm-hmm. So when they start needing input from both the social services and, I don't know, speech and language therapist or an occupational therapist or a district nursing team, that's a potential trigger to start thinking about whether or not now is the time to think about how to manage your patient differently.
Yeah.
And even like community pharmacists, and you know, they are a huge resource. And actually, you know, that first phone call of I can't come in and pick up my prescription anymore, actually, can you deliver it to me? It's an ideal opportunity for everyone to start thinking about their frailty scales and actually assessing what's people happening? Against where they are right now and has that changed?
Yeah. So as you say, if you recognise that people are having frailty, so a lot of the e-frailty index we're going to mention a little bit later as an opportunity from GP data to recognise frailty in people. Also, if people are seeking unplanned care or attending A&E quite often.
Yeah, or falling over.
And quite often patients, you know, they'll have, you know, 10 or 12 medicines and they'll be managing perfectly fine in original pack. Suddenly they need a blister pack and suddenly then that needs to be delivered. Actually, all of those are trigger points for you to understand that even either cognitively or physically, this patient is deteriorating.
Yeah. But all of those things, are, I think, are what you might call sort of opportunistic times to intervene. You can also be
a
bit more proactive. Mm. Yeah. And the guideline talks about using validated tools to assess patients for their multi-morbidity or their risk of frailty. And Joe's already mentioned the e-frailty index, and we've talked about that before, I think, on the frailty episodes, which was series 2 episode 1. P&E and Q admissions, which are both sort of web-based frailty assessment tools.
Q admissions I had to look up, I have to be honest, but it's a, as you say, it's a web-based tool calculator, and it looks at people who are having lots of admissions and then kind of helps you to risk stratify them.
Cool.
And P&E is quite nice. It stands for Predicting Emergency Care Use Over the Next Year.
Oh, that's quite nice.
Like to the point. Yeah.
And I guess that really uses the electronic health records held by the patient's primary care team.
I think they can be quite difficult, though, because, you know, I know that a lot of kind of primary care pharmacy services specifically talking about, you know, they use the top 2% as their risk factors for that proactive care. But for quite a lot of patients, you know, they won't always fall into those and they'll fall into them acutely.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's why it's so important that all of these isolated services we have for falls and for this, you know, that everyone's considering.
And that's a bit more reactive, isn't it? They're already using healthcare services enough instead of kind of saying, OK, who are those people that are silently we're not seeing?
Absolutely.
Trying to help those. Yeah. Routine review of medications by the GP, re-prescribing medications, doing repeat prescriptions.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've got opinions on that, right?
The trigger is people on 15 medications.
Which is just madness.
That's madness.
It's because
that's what NICE say, not us.
But there's been so much, and you know, there's been King's Fund, there's been NICE coming out, Scotland and Wales have their own definitions, but you know, in reality, they all talk about a number of medicines. I think King's Fund came out with appropriate or problematic polypharmacy as opposed to an actual number. But really, we cannot put a number to it.
Yeah.
You know, every year a patient in primary care will have to have a medicines review. It's not always done by a GP. It can be done by a nurse at an asthma review, a diabetes review. Honestly, I think that we don't have that holistic approach of anyone actually asking, does somebody still need it? And when we talk about a polypharmacy review, it's very different to a medicines review because in the approach that you're taking to it. And yeah, I don't like a number attached. You can have somebody on 20 medicines and they're completely appropriate and the patient is absolutely fine. And you can have a patient on 2 or 3 medicines where they're causing huge amounts of problems. They're not appropriate anymore. And it can be a reason for an admission.
Going back to you saying that polypharmacy review and medicines review are different from your perspective, do you want to explain what that is?
Well, I think
you might not know.
I think, you know, when people are doing a medicines review, they're generally very disease focused. As I said, you'll go in and you'll have a respiratory review, you'll have a diabetes review. And actually, it's about making sure that one single condition is treated and is optimized, again, according to single guidance. the big focus for pharmacy now is polypharmacy review. It's really about asking, is there any evidence for it? The answer of always will be no. However, it's about saying, you know, for me, a very crude question is, how long do we expect this person to live? Mm. Specifically, you know, for those really older patients. And it gives you a guide, and I use Rockwood to give me a guide as to where actually this patient is in their frailty scale. Mm. And asking, do they still need it? You know, what happens if we took it away? And it's about justifying giving it to them as opposed to not giving it to them.
That leads on nicely to the next section, which says that if you recognise multimorbidity in people through whichever means, you should also think about assessing them for frailty, because they do overlap.
Okay. And then I think the second section really is starting to talk about principles of an approach to care. Mm. So starting to think about, what should we do now? Now that we've recognised someone's got multimorbidity, what do we start doing about it? And the guideline starts off by suggesting that we should offer an approach to care that takes account of the multimorbidity and focuses on how the person's health conditions and their treatments interact and how this is affecting their quality of life. Mm. And I really think that's asking us to move away from like a chain way of thinking. So A to B to C, and if that happens, go to D, or if this happens, go to E, to a much more sort of networked, interlinked way of thinking about things. Mm. Saying, well, actually, you know, if A happens, well, actually, the next thing that may need to happen is E. And we may not need to do B, C and D, or we may need to do B, C and D in this particular patient. And it's really about involving the person in that discussion.
Mm. I was just going to say that, because I think that, you know, I come from a very different kind of perspective from you guys, and you'll see patients coming in an acute episode of care, and instantly your brains will go to, right, so they have this, so they need this, this and this. From my perspective, I guess I see them at the moment on the opposite side, where the first question I ask is, what do you want? Mm. Actually, you know, they may present to A&E having had a fall, be that through a hypoglycemia or a postural drop. But actually, they may want to take their medicines. They may want more medicines. Mm. And I think we all assume that medicines are bad in old people and that we have to take them away. But, you know, they actually might quite like taking their 20 medicines every single day. And it's about initially just saying to that person, okay, like, that's why I like the multimorbidity guidance. It gives you that backup of saying, if you have this, there is less chance of you having this event, giving that choice to the patient.
Yeah. And it talks about establishing the patient's goals, their values and their priorities.
Absolutely.
And that's absolutely key to delivering the sort of care that people need when they've got multimorbidity.
And I don't think anyone's doing that particularly well currently.
So the other thing it kind of flags up is, as well as being alert to the possibility that someone might have frailty with multimorbidity, that they may also have depression or anxiety in relation to their chronic health conditions. So that's something to really try and opportunistically find or look for when you're seeing these people as well.
Which is one of the things with our patients. And that was part of her interventions that is the most numerous, really, is the management of those associated mental health conditions, which may be caused or precipitated by the physical conditions that she's got.
And sometimes that helps you to focus, actually, your priorities for the physical treatments, isn't it? Is which ones are having an effect on her mental health.
So. And pain is another thing that's really underreported and really under the radar.
We've done an episode on pain, and we've got one coming up soon in this series on non-pharmacological managements of pain as well.
Mm, quite excited about that one.
Yeah. So how do you go about looking at their medicines? That's going to be the mainstay of the rest of the episode.
Yeah.
There are some quite nice tools around, and some of them are more usable than others. Stop-start is something you quite like, Ian.
And there's Beer's Criteria I quite like too. Mm. Stop-start, I think, is quite useful, particularly because it's built into the polypharmacy app for the sign guidelines.
Which is really nice.
Which is really nice, and I think it's quite usable. If you've not got that, you should get that.
The thing I really like about the app is at the end of the app, if you like, at the back of the guidance, there's a link to the trials that shows you what the trials, what the population was, how long the follow-up was, the number needed to treat and things like that. So if you have a specific area, you can actually look and say, okay, well, this is the evidence for that area that exists, and then be able to apply it to your patient.
And the NICE guidelines, multimorbidity, has an Excel spreadsheet of the same thing.
Yeah.
Which is great.
And then the NICE guidelines also talk about optimising other treatments, so not just medications, but also the non-pharmacological treatments. And again, we'll talk about some of those in our episode in pain coming up. And for people that haven't been started on some of these, if they're relevant for them, that may well be a really key and important part in their ongoing management rather than giving more medications.
Just to say, I know that stop start and beers criteria are really nice, but from a pharmacist's perspective, for more junior pharmacists or those kind of wanting to learn more about how you would approach a review, NHS Scotland 2015 have a really nice polypharmacy guideline. It has 7 steps to a medication review, and there's the All Wales Strategic Medicines Group 2014, which has a really nice document for anybody who's kind of wanting to go back. It's got nice little diagrams. It's really easy to follow, highlighting all of those high-risk combo drugs, how to actually perform a medicine review and what you should be considering.
And we're going to put a link to those in the show notes so that you can access them if you're interested in having a look. Next, we're going to do a bit of that, like how you might approach a polypharmacy review. One of the things that's in the NICE guidance and resonates with me quite a lot is focusing on the treatments that are intended to relieve symptoms and provide benefits at the moment or are causing harms. So, as you said, this is up to the patient, but, you know, a number of people are like, I want to get rid of some. Where do we start?
90% of them.
That's where I start.
90%, yeah. And usually when I'm doing a medicines review, you know, the first thing I do is try and establish if the patient has any idea what they're taking in the first instance, because what doctors believe they're taking and what they are taking are two entirely different things. So establishing, do they know what they're taking? And that gives you a really good idea as to where they're at with their medications on a day-to-day basis. And from that, they will generally start to tell you, I don't like taking that one because it makes me feel sick, or I don't like taking this one. And you have very quickly established exactly what you're going to stop.
They do it for you in a way.
Absolutely. And by just simply having a conversation, they may, you know, lots of 70, 80, 90 year olds on statins, actually they're, you know, they'll tell you my muscles are weak, my legs are a bit achy, and you explore that a bit further and, you know, they're doing your job for you essentially. But for me, you know, the symptomatic relief, you know, what is the purpose of this? Is it replacing something vital like thyroxine? If it is, well, then you don't go near it. Is it providing day-to-day symptomatic relief? You know, be that pain through analgesia? You know, and if the answer to no is to those questions is, well, you consider either reducing the dose or stopping it. And having those conversations about stopping is really interesting, because that's why the sign and the NICE guidelines are nice. You know, you have the evidence behind you to give people the risks. But in 90% of the cases, they'll be quite happy to try and stop it.
The only drug they specifically mention in the NICE guidance is bisphosphonates.
It is.
Hand back over to Ian.
Yeah, because that's sort of one of my things. So what they say is that we should tell a person who's been taking bisphosphonates for osteoporosis for at least 3 years that there is no consistent evidence of further benefit from continuing the bisphosphonates for another 3 years. And that they suggest that we should discuss stopping a bisphosphonate after 3 years, but to include the patient choice, the fracture risk and the life expectancy in this discussion. And I think that really, for me, just hammers home the point. Because if you've got someone who is relatively fit and well and has quite advanced osteoporosis is in their early 70s, then actually their fracture risk, and on discussion with them, you may want to continue their treatment for much, much longer. But equally, if you've got somebody who has many, many comorbidities and is relatively frail and is in their late 80s, early 90s, then you may say, well, 3 years of bisphosphonate treatment is going to provide you bone protection for the next 5-7 years. Maybe that swings the risk-benefit balance for you and frames the conversation in a slightly different way. But it really, as I said, to me, just hammers home the point that it's about shared decision-making between you and the patient. And it's part of our job, I think, is to inform the patient, to help them make the decisions with us.
And I think we need to be really careful, because quite a lot of the GP, like primary care coifs and things, go around falls and being on bone protection. And quite a lot of the time, it is an automatic process that you sit in front of somebody and you think, oh, yes, I need to do this.
Which is great.
Absolutely. But the thought process behind it, you know, needs to be a little bit more in depth, in the sense of you're looking at the person sitting in front of you. I've you know, seen bedbound 95-year-olds on both calcium and a bisphosphonate, and actually you think about, well, when did this start? And actually at each of your yearly reviews,
you have to say, was there an indication for this in the first place?
Absolutely.
Is there still an indication for this at this time?
Absolutely.
Or is that expired and long
Absolutely.
Gone?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So if we go back to our case now, we've taken our case and we've given the case to some of our colleagues at work, and we've asked them to talk through their management of this lady.
And how they would approach it.
And how they approach it, and this is what they said.
I'm a consultant geriatrician with responsibility for both inpatient and outpatient care. I think that the case that's quoted is very real in our day-to-day practice. We commonly see patients with multiple morbidity and also in a frail physical state. And in managing their conditions, it is very important to, one, look at the clinical situation holistically, but also take into the account patients' physical state and patients' wish and outlook in their own lives. This is an area that's very interesting and quite a challenge to all of us who look after older patients. The clinical evidence in relation to intervention that would have long-term benefit when applied to older patients have inherent weakness, because a lot of the time the clinical trials for these agents do not include this particular group of patients in the study. I think that would be the first point. Second is to think about the uses of such agent in relation to the individual patient's wish and outlook. There are certain patients whose needs and wish would be for short-term benefit and rather than long-term gain, whereas there are others who would want to ensure that they are, you know, protected from any possible long-term consequence of their illness. So we need to take that into account as well. The other factor that tend to have to come to play would be the cognitive state of the patient. We're seeing increasing number of patients with cognitive impairment. They will not be able to cope with multiple medications so well, and in fact, maybe some of these preventive agents will not benefit them. Clinical guidance is a very, very useful tool to help us to practice evidence-based medicine. But we also need to ensure that there cannot be clinical guidance or guidelines that would apply to all the clinical situation and the interaction of the conditions that patients have. And therefore, in delivering care to older patients, we need to be very, very conscious of the interaction of the number of clinical conditions, but also the interaction of medications that we'll be providing them.
So if you've got anything else that you want to tell us or you want to tell other people about multimorbidity, then please do drop us a line, and we can be found at MDT_podcast on Twitter.
On Facebook at MDT Podcast.
On our website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk. In particular, if you would like to get involved in this show, if you would like to be some of the shop floor edits that we use, you can record them and you can send them to us.
Yes. So we just record them on our phones at work. Obviously, make sure there are no patients around or people talking about patients. But other than that, if you have something, on any of the upcoming episodes, and they will be listed on our website, then feel free to send those to us and we may use them.
The MDT Podcast.
So now it's the time of the week for our quiz, the MD teaser. This is our catchily titled MDT item guessing game, but it's different.
It is different. Tappy, who is our clinical fellow who works with us to help us develop the series, has created the game for us.
Yes. So we have cards in this envelope. So what we have on these cards is two things. First of all, a main word at the top that we're going to try and get somebody to guess. And then underneath, a list of words that we're not allowed to use in our description.
Mm-hmm.
Mairead is going to time, Joe.
Yeah.
And the winner is the person that makes the other person guess the answer quickest.
Okay, so what's our time limit?
Should we say 30 seconds?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So would you like to go first or second, Joe?
I would like to go first.
Okay, you can go first.
All right.
Right, ready?
Mm-hmm.
3, 2, 1, go.
These are something that you would put on your face.
Glasses.
Yes.
Oh, that was a bit quick.
That was. That means I'm amazing at it, right?
I think that's what that means.
That's what I'm going to go with anyway.
Okay.
The words I was not allowed to use were eyes, see, vision, and sun. Ah, sunglasses. Uh-huh. That's a good clue. Cool.
Right, so my
All
turn.
Right, your turn.
Ready?
How long was that, Mairead?
I think by the time I actually got to stop it was about 6 seconds.
Okay, so okay.
We've so including Mairead's
reaction
times.
No, we'll go with 6 seconds. All right. So this is, ready?
Yep. Go.
So this is something that you used to help someone walk to stop them falling over. They can use it at home or when they go out and about. More commonly, people use it when they go out and about rather
walking
than...
Walking stick.
Yes. I wasn't allowed to use the words hold, hand, steady or balance. And now we've got one for you. But the one for you is slightly different. You're now going to hear a sound and we want you to tell us what that sound is.
So you're going to hear the sound twice, once this episode and once in the next episode, and then we'll switch it to another one.
Yeah, so we'll give you the answer in episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
But still send us your answers because we have prizes and we will give one of the famous MDT mugs to the first person that gives us the correct description of what this sound is.
So the sound that you will hear is something that you would encounter routinely during your work, either in the hospital or in the community. So that's it for this episode. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with an episode on constipation. The MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT podcast is a hearing aid podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.